Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman.
And I'm Kiran Chetri, and this is Future Proof. You know, Jeremy, when I was working as a TV journalist, I moved to a lot of places, especially when I was working, you know, at different affiliates across the country. And there's always a sense of trepidation about the unknown. What part of town should I rent in? Should I buy? How are the schools? Is there going to be any art and culture? Where should I eat? Is there access to good medical care? You know, a lot of questions. And our next guest today is the CEO of a company that's trying to help make those moves easier for people, as well as to help incoming college students make informed choices about where they want to attend.
Right. Yeah. So joining us today on Future Proof is Luke Skirman. I'm really excited about this. CEO, and he's the mind behind Niche.com. Niche is a company and a website that uses advanced technology to help people find the best places to work, live, and send their kids to school. And it's come up on my radar lately a lot. So it also helps graduates decide where they want to attend college.
Jeremy, before when I talked to Luke, I said I knew you were going to pronounce it niche versus niche.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep. First off, we're Pennsylvanians. We're going to say niche.
Yeah. First off, Luke, welcome. And so, Luke, how do you say niche?
So I grew up or niche, and I said niche growing up. But when we decided to brand and call the company Niche, we felt we did enough user research where most of Americana were saying niche. Now, throughout this journey, there's been so many pronunciations: niche, niche, niche. People say it so many different ways, but we say it as niche.com.
And so you don't hate people like me who say it wrong, but still believe strongly in what you're doing. So I'm not an enemy of the state. Okay, cool. Sounds good. I think one thing that I really wanted to ask you just to start out is, you guys really purport to have the most comprehensive data available on U.S. schools and neighborhoods. And I was wondering if you could elaborate on that a little bit.
Sure. Yeah. So first of all, at a high level, we have coverage on every single college in the United States. That's more than 5,000 colleges. So that's every four-year school, that's online schools, that's career schools, that's trade schools. We have every single college in the United States on our site. And we have all 120,000 K-12 schools. That's kindergartens, middle schools, high schools, private schools, public schools, charter schools, parochial schools. And we have every city, town, neighborhood, suburb in the United States. So it's a lot that we're covering. And then on top of that, we have all the hard data, things that we get, whether it's from the Department of Education, from the FBI, from the census, from the weather. And then we have all this user-generated content. We have outcomes. We develop our own rankings. We have outcomes. We have statistics. We have facts. We have opinions. We have reviews. And you add it all up, it's quite expansive. We have 120 million reviews and opinions. We have hard data and rankings on every city, every school, every college in the country. Yeah, I do think it's fair to say we have the most comprehensive data set. We have the qualitative and the quantitative in spades.
So when you decided to start the company, Niche.com, how did you know that you were going to be able to do it better? Because there are a lot of ranking systems out there, for colleges and universities, as well as for places to live and
sure.
schools to
attend.
Sure,
so we got our toehold in the college space. That's where we really built the business. And we had so backing up for me, I was born in New York City. I grew up in San Francisco, and I really wanted to...
Wait, sorry. Where in New York? I got to ask as a New Yorker.
Sure. So my mom is from Scarsdale. My dad is from Long Island, but I was born right in the West Village. And then they quickly had a negotiation, my parents, where my dad did not want to live in a suburb and my mom did not want to raise me in Manhattan. So they moved to San Francisco. So we moved to San Francisco when I was very young. I'm an only child. So mom and dad still live out there. But most of my relatives, my cousins, my aunts, my uncles, almost everyone else lives on the East Coast. But I grew up in the Bay Area. And I always wanted to go to college on the East Coast. I wanted that East Coast experience. And I realized that coming from a public high school in the Bay Area, there weren't a lot of kids from my public high school that were going to college on the East Coast. And this was this big decision. I was going 3,000 miles across the country. My parents were going to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars. You're going to spend 4 years of your life. You're going to make these friends. It's going to lead to this first job. It was a big decision. And long story short, what I quickly realized was that there was a lot of schools where you could get a great education. But the bigger question quickly came to me was, where were you going to fit in and be happy? Where were you going to thrive? Yes, you could get a great education in a lot of places, but where were you going to prosper? Where were you going to really be happy?
And that's where you figured out it was going to be Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh.
And I knew what I wanted, and I got exactly what I wanted. But when I went to CMU, I realized that some folks loved Carnegie Mellon and some folks, it wasn't the right school. Carnegie Mellon is a very academically intense school. You usually go to CMU when you know what you want to study. It's not some big party school. It's not some big rah-rah school. It's not Division I athletics. You go there for a killer education, and that's what you go to Carnegie Mellon for. And I realized that there's a lot of people that were making this big decision, and in a lot of ways, they were really rolling the dice. And the biggest thing for us was this kind of insider opinion. It was the students needed a larger voice. There was people that were covering and writing about the universities, ranking the schools and whatnot, but they weren't having enough input from people that were really on the ground experiencing it. Kind of like a Zagat, kind of like a Yelp, kind of like a TripAdvisor, in that you needed that insider opinion. Yet we also really wanted the hard data, the rankings, the data, the stats, the facts as well. We wanted both. And so that's where we started. And today, almost 60% of every high school senior in the United States that goes to a four-year college has an account on our website. We have crazy large market share. So that was our toehold. And we said, wow, we've got this market. The higher education industry is going to tip. They're going to spend more of their dollars, more of their mind share digitally, but it moves slowly. So let's bring our recipe of user-generated content, of rankings, of data, of facts. Let's bring that to more markets. So the second market then we went into was coverage on all 120,000 K-12 schools. So we said, okay, let's see if we can do this to the K-12 market as well. And we saw there was a lot of traffic there, and it wasn't being covered, you know, thoroughly enough. There are a few things that were really light, like private schools and school districts. One-off public schools were getting covered fairly well, but there was more opportunity there. So we went into K through 12 space. And then shortly after, with some user testing, we realized that folks that were interested in K through 12 schools were often interested in real estate, and that the price of a home was correlated to the quality of a school district. If you were thinking about schools, you were often thinking about moving, you were thinking about the price of a home. It was a very interconnected decision. So first it was colleges, then it was K through 12 schools, and then it was places to live. And then we're coming out soon with places to work, grad schools, and preschools.
That's interesting, because obviously a lot of this is really based off of the data that you guys hold on all these different locations and institutions. And a core theme of what we try to discuss on the show is that we can really all use data to make better decisions, and we will be using data in the future to make better decisions than we do now. So, I mean, I'm kind of wondering about education as well as location, places to live. How do those topics fit into the idea of using data to make better decisions?
Sure, I'll give you two quick anecdotes. So one is, so first I had the experience choosing a college. Now I'm a new dad, which is true. And I'm thinking about where to buy a home for my family. What's the right place to live? And I'm thinking about where to send my son for kindergarten. These big decisions come up time and time again. And what most people do is they talk to their friends, word of mouth, and it's all anecdotal. But if you were using some more data, you could be so much smarter about these key multi-year seminal decisions that when you look back in time, change your entire life, choosing a school, choosing a college, where to live, where to work. These are big decisions that impact your entire life. So on the flip side, think about baseball for a second. Think about Moneyball. Think about how much money they're analyzing for every strike, every walk, every home run, how many data scientists are analyzing every stat, but you're not thinking about where you're going to live, where you're going to work, where you're going to go to school, where you're going to go to college. And these are the decisions that impact years of your life. And that's what we're thinking about, is how to make people help them make more better informed decisions.
I remember the olden days because we're a little bit older than you, I can tell, even though you are a new dad, congratulations. When I was applying to schools, you know, as you said, a lot of word of mouth, and then you would, you know, hop in the car with your parents and your little glossy, you know, flyer about the school, and you'd go visit. And you know, that's fine if you had a very short list, but for some people who have absolutely no idea, I mean, it's extremely time consuming and expensive. How much would you say that you're able to pare down that process for people of actually having to go there? How much can they sort of weed out by using your site?
A visit is great. Okay, you can't replace a visit, but to your point, it's expensive. We're not trying to replace a visit. We're just trying to help you and give you more confidence that when you do go on a few visits, or you want to get deeper, you've already gotten a lot of confidence. You already have a much better sense of what it's really like.
There's this idea of a lot of more people are working virtually, and they might live in a remote area that they want to live in, and then just kind of telecommute from a long distance. There are a lot of teams that are put together in that manner. So just to kind of challenge in some ways, do you think that physical location is going to matter as much in the future? You know, forget, leave education aside for a second, but even just in terms of places to live, places to work and, you know, spend your life, does it matter as much as it used to, given the fact that we are now super connected with places that are very remote?
Like, regardless of my business, I think that, I mean, you see the retail apocalypse or whatever you want to call it, that the world is changing dramatically, okay? But what I often see when I go to all these cities is that it's office space, it's coffee shops, and it's restaurants. So people are still trying to find authentic ways to connect with one another. And I don't think schools or colleges or where you live or where you work, I don't think those things are changing anytime soon. I think, yeah, retail and Amazon, yeah, that's changing a lot. But these authentic touch points, so you're not insular and on an island and you're by yourself, yeah, I don't think that's the future. I think people are still going to find authentic ways to interact with each other. I think schools are still going to exist. I think there's going to be a lot of adaptation and those models are going to change dramatically. But I think that schools and companies and workplaces, I do believe that they'll still be a big place of society.
You talked about report cards. And so I typed in my zip code and I see that you also have interesting little tidbits, you know, like it said number 46 best zip code in New York State. I also saw that where I live got an A+, public schools got an A+, but then affordable housing, cost of living, C-minus, some of the weathers were Bs. How did it come out to be an overall A+?
Our data science team, you know, is grading everything. And we create, not to get too wonky here, we create Z scores and we have kind of regression analysis. And we pick out and we can see, even no place is perfect, but we can see which place statistically is at the strongest end of it. So usually, to simplify, the top 2 or 5% of anything are still going to be our A+ schools, colleges, places to live. So even though there's some C's and B's in there, overall, in the most important areas, like public schools, let's say, they're probably scoring very well. And yeah, the overall score is good enough to still be an A+. So it's probably a top 2 or 5% in our overall score. And there's a few scores in there that are weighted higher than other scores.
Got it. Jeremy, why don't we do a lightning round just for fun with Luke?
I'll start off.
Go ahead.
Best single thing about Pittsburgh?
The people. So again, when you go to New York or you go to San Francisco, I love those people. But here, the people are so sincere. They're so genuine. They're so honest. They're so hardworking. It's just incredibly refreshing. You feel like there's people that are authentic. They're real. They treat you with a lot of respect and dignity. I can't say enough about the people here.
Yeah, it's a very, very nice town. I lived a little bit outside of it. I thought you were going to say Permane Brothers sandwiches, which by the way, Jeremy, you know I like to eat. Pittsburgh has this famous sandwich, which is basically like meat, cheese, and then they throw on French fries. They throw on coleslaw, an egg
I'm
if
there.
You want it.
This sounds great.
Extremely popular. All right, what's the worst place you've ever visited?
All right, I know. I know it's probably I'm putting a political firestorm by saying this, but I would say the worst place I've ever been was Moscow, Russia. I did not enjoy that trip. I always really thought I wanted to go to Moscow. I thought I would love it there. And I went there. It was a very cold place. It was very dark. You go even to the modern art museums, and the paintings were never bright. They were never colorful. Everyone looked miserable in all the paintings. It was not welcoming to non-Russians. I did not have a good time in Moscow at all. I did not enjoy it.
We got to make sure that Luke just doesn't get poisoned shortly after this podcast airs. That's the most important thing.
Watch out for those rice and darts, I'll tell you. Well, I'm from Nepal, so I can say this, but I had the least amount of fun in New Delhi, India, probably because I got really, really sick there. I think I got food poisoning, so I think that may have tainted it for me. But it was also super, super crowded, and I thought I lost my parents for a few minutes, and I was just very not happy there. But there were other parts of India that I absolutely loved. And of course, Kathmandu, which I absolutely love. But that New Delhi trip, man, that took a lot out of me. Let me ask you this, Luke. What startup do you, or it doesn't have to be just one, but so some startups that you really admire that you didn't think would make it, maybe that you thought were kind of off the beaten trail, and they ended up being something that you really look to as a business model?
I mean, it depends on how big we want to go. I'll give you one that maybe not everybody knows about. It's still a big company that probably has an enterprise value of over $100 million now. So it's not tiny, but it's not billions or tens of billions, but there's a fellow entrepreneur from Carnegie Mellon, and he's built a company called Everlane. Everlane is kind of like the modern millennial J. Crew, and it's just got killer clothes, great weekend bags, great t-shirts, super high quality. Their tagline is radical transparency. I love what those guys are doing. I think they're killing it. They just opened up their first two retail shops in New York and San Francisco. They really have a lot of momentum. I think they're really cool.
Obviously, it's very important that you factor in input and feedback from users. So how do you not just collect these data points, but invite the user in order to get better and better data about these schools?
Yeah, I think there's a real culture of wanting to kind of pay it forward. So one thing that we did really well was we had all these high school seniors that were researching colleges, and then we started frankly asking them, hey, can you tell us about your high school? And frankly, getting, when you have this much market share, the private schools, it's very hard to get that data, but we were able to crowdsource that data, and they told us their SAT scores. They told us what colleges they were going to. We got some really unique, compelling data that just doesn't exist. And then they get on campus, they go to college, and again, they had a good experience on our site. They enjoyed it, and they want to tell us about their college experience. So we've tried to create a culture where our users really want to help one another. Another thing that we've done, I think it was somewhat lucky, is that it's not that easy to create an account on our website. So there's not like a lot of really weak reviews. You really need to go through a pretty thorough registration process, and you really must care. And you really do end up, I think, writing better reviews than just like, you know, writing not as thick and as thorough of a review as you could. So we kind of have a high bar for registration as well.
I want to ask you guys about this, simply because we've been talking about the use of data, how important data is in the future and in our future decision making. It can be a double-edged sword as well. Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook founder, got a lot of heat this week in online commentary and also in the media for seeming to be a little bit nonchalant about this revelation that a data mining firm, Cambridge Analytica, that worked with the Trump presidential campaign as well as other campaigns, harvested 50 million Facebook user profiles. This is back in 2014, unauthorized, and then used them to build a powerful software system to be able to predict and influence people's choices at the ballot box vis-a-vis targeted ads, etc. Zuckerberg basically said, you know, privacy, protecting people's privacy and information is like our number one job, so we have to do it better in the future. And a lot of people said, wait, you have to do it better in the future. There is also, according to a few published sites like The Guardian out of the UK, saying that Facebook actually knew about this by late 2015, and they really didn't tell their users, and they seemed to take only limited steps to try to recover and secure the information. Do you think Facebook and Zuckerberg are getting a bad rap, or do you think that that they could have done more?
So first of all, you know, when you look at like an Equifax, a Wells Fargo, a Facebook, you're seeing, you know, huge kind of data breaches across the board. I don't think this is going to slow down. I think you're going to see more and more. When you sign on for these various services, these various companies, these various offers, they have carte blanche in those legal terms to really do a lot, even if the user doesn't understand that. They've opted in and agreed to almost giving them the keys to the castle in exchange for this basically free service. I think at the end of the day, you know, legal aside, rights aside, it is up to the business to create trust and to make sure that even if they have those rights, that they're not violating their users and that they are really not just maximizing every dollar, every revenue, every bottom line, but they're also creating a good business and good trust. And I think the problem ultimately with Facebook is that there has been a time and a feeling for a long time that they say what they need to say, and they sometimes get their hand slapped, but they're not always sincere in that belief. And that people, I think, are feeling that they are not all, that they're not really trusting their personal information. They really are mining it and selling it and working on it, and they're not being sincere about it.
What about how much onus, Jeremy, lies on the user as well? I mean, how many of us sit there and actually read the user agreements and say, oh, wow, you know, there's a chance that some of my information could go to a third party?
I'm not at all. This isn't a thing that I'm surprised about. This is a thing that I was talking about a while ago. To me, the bigger question is how many other people did this? It almost looks like if you were a third party app and you weren't trying to harvest data from Facebook, aren't you, even you could be talking about being unethical, sure, but aren't you just like, isn't it your onus to try to do that?
Right, you're saying you're missing the boat if you're not doing it. I mean, look at all these people.
So third-party apps that were able to do this surely are, you're right, like data does need to be something that people look carefully at. Privacy is another key thing. But I also think that the onus has to be on, going back to Kieran, to your point, the user to understand that like Facebook is a business, and there are a lot of businesses that are providing all these awesome free things that you didn't have when you were growing up. And you have to be willing to give something up for these things. If you don't want to, there are some people who choose not to play in this space. They're not giving anything up and they're not getting value out of it. And that's fine. But I don't think it's okay. Like, there's a lot of onus on Facebook, a lot of onus on any third-party apps that don't follow the rules or have malicious intent, but there has to be some onus on the user to understand that nothing is entirely free and you're giving something up.
And I also think that, you know, I think that any expectation of privacy in this world right now, when you put as much information as we do, as much personal information as we do online, I think that you're naive. The only exception being that, you know, with the push toward online banking and asking people to go paperless, I think that when it comes to, you know, securing your accounts and your money, as well as your health data, I think that those are areas where sectors that have to be extremely, extremely, extremely vigilant, or they can't expect people to go with them. But in terms of social media sharing, I mean, I think that it is absolutely naive to believe that all of the information you put out there, they just want to know for fun. They just want to know so they can see how many University of Maryland kids are out there. No, it's obviously going to be used to target, you know, what you buy, what you're influenced by, and where you go and what sites you use. And I think that it's pretty naive to think that you know, again, you don't get something for nothing.
Yeah, I think that if you really look under the hood and you really are honest about it, I bet that Apple, Google, Microsoft, and Facebook are all doing things that we don't like. That being said, I probably trust Apple the most. I probably trust Facebook the least. And Microsoft and Google are probably somewhere in the middle. But I think they're all doing something.
Yeah, they're all doing something. They're all up to something out there. We just can't quite get a finger on it.
The thing with Facebook is that they have 2 billion users. I agree with your point. There's some onus on the user, but when you're at that scale and the whole world is only 6 billion, 7 billion people, and you have 2 billion people, yeah, the user needs to be smart, but they also just have a duty at that level of that impact. They just have to be a little bit, they just have to have some conscience for the greater good as well.
If your platform and other platforms like it in other, you know, non-competitive fields, I'm thinking kind of like ZocDoc or Yelp, other things that allow people to select the best things for them, whether it's colleges or restaurants or neighborhoods to live in and so on. What does that future look like when everybody's essentially in the right place for them? How does that actually impact the world in one way or another?
I guess in a perfect world, what we're trying to do is shine a light on the situation. We just want to be transparent and honest. Here's what's going well. Here's what's not going well. We want to make the folks ultimately step up their game that aren't doing a good job so that they provide a better service, whether it's a better school, it's a better place to live, it's a better college. If you're not cutting it, you got to step up your game. You got to have a better product. We just want to show the truth. That's all we're really trying to do. We're not policy people. We're not trying to tell them that they're bad people, but we want to say it like it is. And this is a good school. This is a bad place. So ultimately, I think you'll see hopefully some migration at some point where we'll go towards the better places. And then ultimately, it's people have to improve their product, whether it's a school, a neighborhood, a restaurant, a company, whatever. You're not going to get away with being subpar in the world of the internet. The world of the internet is it provides transparency to everything, and you have to recognize that.
Have you thought of or learned anything where the data kind of contradicted your past beliefs? I'm thinking there could be a particular city or a particular school where you had a previous assumption about what kind of like where it sat in the hierarchy, but then you looked at the data and you realized, well, actually the data and my beliefs.
Yeah. I'll give you an example. I don't want to name names here, but there's a very highly ranked kindergarten in Pittsburgh that I recently visited with my wife as a place to consider having our son go. And it's ranked really high. And I went there, and what was missing though was it felt like everyone there was very angry. The teachers were angry. They were very disciplined oriented. It did not seem like a happy place. Yeah, they probably work you so hard that you get the scores and you get the results. But I didn't think that my son, who I want to protect his emotional intelligence and his emotional well-being, I didn't think that was the right environment for him. So those are the little moments where you have to go kind of test these things, and you got to step back and make sure you're capturing things correctly. Because I wasn't sure that this school really, you know, that's the thing is we help you get a list, a ranking, and then it's your job to then go, you know, really make sure you got the right fit. And that wasn't the right fit for us.
Maybe I can ask that last question that I had on my list, which is, so I actually saw that you guys raised a little capital recently. Congrats on that.
Thank you.
Continue to build niche.com. I'm trying to say it your way. So when you're trying to innovate, how important is it to be able to sell people, you know, such as investors, on your vision of the future?
Oh, it's really important. I mean, what an investor wants ultimately is a few things, but it really comes down to a big market opportunity. They want to know how fast you're growing. They want to know how well you're executing right now. They want to know how competitive you are. Can you keep up your position in the market, or is everyone going to pass you up? How proprietary? Do you have a moat? So there's a lot of things that people think about, but yeah, people are really excited about what we're doing. I mean, this month we're going to do close to 10 million visits. Our traffic is growing almost 80% year over year. We've got all this content. We're moving into more markets. It's a very exciting time over here.
That's wonderful. Well, clearly Carnegie Mellon did you right. Luke Skirman, the CEO of niche.com, or as Jeremy likes to say, niche.com. I actually started saying niche, Jeremy, because I've lived in New York so long. Luke, it was really great talking to you, and good luck with niche.com. It looks like a great site, and as we've seen, it's helping a lot of people, and that's my dog barking. She's saying goodbye. That's Charlie saying she wants to go. She wants to go to University of Pittsburgh.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. It was great to be here today. Have a great weekend, and I'll talk to you both soon.
Thank you, Luke, and thank you to everybody who's listening right now. Your help and support totally means a lot to us, and make sure to subscribe if you haven't already. Review us on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people find out about us. We've heard that that's been a really big help to everybody so far in finding us. And until next time, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.